Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Each weekday morning, the Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review, we feature selections from this week's shows. On Wednesday, January 21st, Joe was joined by public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Robert Griffin, Senior Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, Robert Pondicio, and former Times Union Associate Editor Mike Spain.
Lindsey Halligan, Trump administration lawyer who was named head of a key U.S. attorney's office in Virginia last year with instructions to seek criminal charges against President Donald Trump's perceived political adversaries, left her post at the Justice Department on Tuesday, not just one
not
Tuesday.
Every Tuesday.
Just every Tuesday she's going to leave. No, all the just this particular Tuesday.
He's gone.
Halligan's departure followed a pair of extraordinary moves by two federal judges who issued court orders hours earlier saying they intended to replace Halligan at the helm of the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Eastern District of Virginia and threatening disciplinary sanctions for any government lawyer who continued to refer to her as U.S. Attorney in legal filings. The separate actions by Chief Judge Hannah Lauck and Judge David Novak, who were nominated by President Obama and Trump, respectively, signaled a breaking point for the federal bench in the Eastern District of Virginia months after Halligan was disqualified from serving as U.S. attorney in the high-profile office. The orders intensified a battle playing out nationwide between the executive and judicial branches over how the nation's 93 U.S. attorneys can be appointed for temporary terms without Senate confirmation. And they had posed obstacles for Halligan, who had no prosecutorial experience before she was installed in the job, as she attempted to carry out Trump's directions to levy criminal charges against two of his perceived political foes, former FBI Director James Comey, and New York Attorney General Letitia James. Halligan, in a statement, accused the district's federal judges of a campaign to pressure her to leave after the court ruling declaring her appointment was invalid. She said that effort had diverted, quote, time and resources from public safety responsibilities. Abby Lowell, an attorney for James who helped argue the case challenging Halligan's appointment last year, said her departure, quote, marks another failure in the Trump administration's illegal attempts to install political lobbyists and loyalists as prosecutors and served as a, quote, fitting end to her brief and troubled tenure in office. Mike.
Well, it just shows that, at a time when so much is going on, this is pretty significant. If there wasn't everything else we've been talking about going on, this would be a big deal. This is a major political loss for Trump and his people. Basically, they flaunt the law, they ignore it, they do whatever they want, and this is a setback. Trump was one of the nominees of these judges, and to use the term charade, this is a charade for, Halligan to call herself a U.S. attorney. I mean, it's big, and it has to. It would otherwise get noticed, and it would be a major political story if we weren't talking about NATO and going to war with our allies,
which all are important things to talk about, of course. Robert.
Okay. On the one hand, I don't think it is crazy to say that Trump was subjected to politically tinged lawfare after his first term. Many folks, serious institutionalists believe that some of those prosecutions were pretextual, opportunistic, animated by political hostility, etc. But recognizing that does not justify turning the Department of Justice into a vehicle for revenge. So here we go again with another one of those what should have been a political win for this president turning into a liability.
Teresa?
I think that the damage that the Trump administration has done to the Justice Department is generational, and it's both by the people that they have brought in and the people that they have driven out. And that started a year ago yesterday when one of his first steps that he took after being sworn into office was to pardon all of the January 6th people who had been convicted of crimes, including the beating of more than 140 police officers. They had, through due process, were convicted, and he pardoned all of them. But not only did he pardon all of those people, but they then began systematically firing the people who worked on those cases. The prosecutors, the researchers, even some of the clerical people driving them out, enormous amounts of talent. And they have continued to do that, both to weaponize the Justice Department in ways that people had long feared, and then to, as I say, bring their own people. And this is one case, the Halligan case, and there's three others, where the courts have put the brakes on it. But I think that we need to be deeply concerned about, and I know, Robert, that's a, conservative line, say, well, the Biden administration did this too, but I don't think that that's compared at all, fair comparison at all.
Yeah, so the silver lining to the story, though, is that at least the balance of power is of powers is being preserved here, with the idea that the executive branch has the right to nominate, but it's got to be confirmed. And
bipartisan judges spoke out and were heard.
Exactly. Right. So
the
actually,
second balance is working.
The system worked the way it was. I'll also say that every single president, I will at least in modern history, has always tried to do interim appointments, has always tried to sort of skirt the process to try to get at sometimes questionable or favored but questionable appointments in. What's also really interesting about this story, Joe, and this also goes not just in the Halligan situation, but also the situation in Minnesota, and where Teresa was going, I think is really important to point out, is that the loss of trained attorneys in the Department of Justice is leaving us the point where there aren't even enough attorneys in the Department of Justice to go into Minnesota and look at the situation there. So we've sort of hollowed out, quote, the bureaucracy, but we have lost an awful lot of capacity. And part of the, I think, frustration with the judges is that having read the Comey paperwork, it was clear to me that Halligan didn't even understand some of the most basic elements of what needed to be done with that case, which is nothing but frustrating, because it just showed a contempt not just of the position, but of the law itself. And this was I'm actually glad to see her go, because it gives me a little bit of hope that there is some elements of the check and balances that remain in place.
But Bob, you can speak to this so much better than me. But there's a price and a cost of what's being done to the Justice Department, and what I so worry about is particularly hollowing out the cybercrime units and stuff, but all of the work that's not being done because skilled people are not there protecting us. But you would know more in terms of detail about the kinds of work that had been done that's not being done now.
Well, it is, and they've taken most of the agents. I'm thinking about ICE and regardless of where ICE is today, part of ICE's issue of mission space is critically important to things like the nuclear proliferation and stopping sex trafficking, and they've taken agents off of a lot of that work. So there's an awful lot of work that's not getting done. We still don't understand the full impact of what DOGE did or continues to do to the federal workforce. Even at the speech that I caught the beginning part of Trump's speech today, and he was crowing about reducing the federal bureaucracy and how he fired all of these federal employees who went to the private sector and made a lot more money and they should be thanking him. To me, though, what made the nation great is that we had some amazing people who were willing to work in for a lot less money than they should have been getting because of the public good. This idea that they were doing something for the country and for their communities, which obviously to for this president means that you're a sucker.
give or take a 250,000 employees was the number I saw.
Yes.
But that, I mean, a story that didn't get enough attention, I think, were the six prosecutors in the Minnesota district,
yeah,
right, who were extremely talented in a wide range of areas, but they left in protest because of how the Trump Justice Department was going to handle or not handle the prosecutions of what's going on with ICE there. Well, and so they left out of conscience. But in terms of the loss across the board, not just of legal folks, what about all those NIH researchers and all that research that then goes with them? What about the FDA? What about the veterans?
But before we go there, let's go back to Robert's comment, because Robert, I think your point is super valid, and we can't lose it here, is that the Justice Department, we want a partisan-free Justice Department. That's what we want. We want the idea of justice to be for all. And the feeling of manipulation, we can talk about what was done under Merrick Garland. We can certainly talk about what's being done with Pam Bondi. I will tell you that where I am right now with the Justice Department is that I feel like, again, this is an institution that needs to be fundamentally rebuilt with stronger guideposts, so that we can ensure that justice is being delivered regardless of who you are.
Yeah,
without fear or favor, and following the rule of law.
Yes.
And that responsibility is on the Congress, who are running from it.
Yeah, because it's their oversight that they're not doing.
But also, I mean, are we going to get to ICE? I don't want to switch.
Yes. I mean, we only have 8 minutes left, but we can certainly start talking about Minnesota and what's happening there. That was the plan. We'll real quick look at where we are here. Two stories. One is that ICE tactics have been criticized. Minnesota police leaders criticized the tactics in the ICE surge. Gregory Bovino, a senior Border Patrol official, said agents were operating lawfully and were focused on individuals who pose a serious threat to the community. Three top Minnesota police officials on Tuesday criticized the tactics that federal agents have used during their immigration crackdown and described a region where residents, including those with legal status, were scared to venture outside. Two of the officials said they knew of U.S. citizens, including a police officer and city workers, who had been stopped and questioned by immigration agents. And they expressed concern that the Trump administration's surge of some 3,000 federal agents to Minnesota was undermining residents' trust in law enforcement and disrupting daily life. That from the Washington Post. Looking at another story that is related, the Justice Department is seeks prosecutors for Minnesota surge and is serving subpoenas. The Justice Department is sending prosecutors from Midwestern states to help the Minnesota U.S. Attorney's Office as it grapples with a severe shortage of staff amid a surge of federal immigration officers, according to three people familiar with the personnel moves. Top Justice Department officials made the urgent request to U.S. attorneys in more than half a dozen states over the weekend as the Trump administration prepares for the possibility of filing charges against state officials and more protesters. Officials asked the U.S. attorneys to send prosecutors for stints in the Minnesota Federal Prosecutor's Office that could last a couple of weeks each. That from the Washington Post.
The conflict is natural, that ICE has a mission, and the mission it seems to have is to round up as many undocumented people as they can and get rid of them. And, you know, send them back home or send them off out of our country. I mean, a primary mission of governors, mayors, police officers is to maintain public safety. And when you inject the fear that ICE is causing into a community by bringing 3,000 people into a city like Minneapolis, and then if a crime is committed, people who are worried and scared are not going to call the police. If they're a victim of a crime, they're not going to call police. If they're injured, they may not go to the emergency room. If their children are sick, their children are probably U.S. citizens. They won't take them to the emergency room. They're afraid to send their kids to school. They're afraid to go shopping. And that is why police and others are not out checking everybody's papers every time they respond to a police call. They want people who are immigrants to drive safely, and that's why some states are letting them be licensed and buy insurance. I mean, it's such a conflict between this mission that ICE now has to just get a million people in the first year of Trump's presidency, and that it's a natural conflict, and you need to respect what government officials are doing for their own people, like in Minnesota, in New York, everywhere.
Teresa?
I think that we have to be clear on what the mission is, that Trump ran on a pledge to close the borders and then to remove violent criminals from the interior of the United States. He described them as the worst of the worst. And that is not what's being done. And in fact, by their own statistics, approximately 7% of the people that they have seized have convictions for violent crimes. There are another 30% or so, a little bit higher, that have convictions of other crimes, but the vast majority of them are traffic crimes. They're nonviolent crimes. And then there are more than 60% of them who have no convictions whatsoever, and there are a significant portion of those who are actually U.S. citizens. But I think that the real issue is that there's been a lot of, and the tactics have been a real problem, and the purpose of the tactics. And Greg Bovino was in there yesterday, and he says that the operation is targeting violent criminals in a manner that is, quote, legal, ethical, and moral, and well-grounded in law. And he says, quote, our operations are lawful, targeted, and focused on individuals who pose a serious threat to this community. They are not random, and they are not political. Those statements, I believe, are not true, and don't take my word for it. Take the 20 or so police chiefs who had a press conference yesterday and who spoke out about their deep concern that they were not following due process. People were being randomly stopped, including law enforcement who are off duty. And the law enforcement off duty were not the white officers. They're the officers of color and women. If you don't take my word for it, take the Farmers Union, the president of the Minnesota Farmers Union. Clearly, those are Trump people who had a press conference in the last few days talking about these ICE tactics that are damaging the farming community and their workers, their friends, their families. Or the medical community who had a press conference in the last 2 days raising concerns, the same thing about the ICE going into hospitals and seizing patients and seizing staff inside of hospitals, let alone the schools and the daycare. I think that this, and a lot of anger of protesters is aimed at ICE, but I think that that needs to be reframed and redirected because these are Trump tactics. And these people are doing these actions in the way that they're doing them because they're financially incentivized to do it by Trump. And that's where the focus needs to be. It needs to stop.
That was Teresa Bourgeois on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, January 21st. We'll be back with more after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Thursday, January 22nd, Joe was joined by founder and academic director of the Hannah Arendt Center for Politics and Humanities and professor of politics, philosophy, and human rights at Bard College, Roger Berkowitz, writer, analyst, recently retired president of Siena College, and former New York congressman, Chris Gibson, and professor emeritus of Russian at Hofstra University, Alexander Mihailovich.
I don't know how to explain what happened yesterday, and I'm not sure what exactly happened yesterday, but here we go. Yesterday morning, we were in this room, and we, for a good part of the time that we were on the air, the president was speaking. The president was talking. And during that time, that was a rambly speech, but that we've come to expect that. But it was really pointed at Europe and then what was going to happen in Greenland. And then he has a meeting, and then suddenly there is a framework of a deal, which seemed very sudden given all of the issues that appeared to be there prior to him landing in Switzerland on Wednesday morning. He has dropped Greenland threats, but Europeans say they are still on guard. European officials say they expect negotiations to touch on expanding the presence of U.S. troops and bases and greater access to investment in minerals. But most are calling what the president did yesterday a U-turn on Greenland, proclaiming that he was negotiating a deal for total access to the Arctic territory and dropping his tariff threats, which eased some pressure in the standoff with America's once closest allies in Europe. But European officials said Thursday that the matter was not settled and they remain on guard. Trump on Thursday suggested he could achieve the goals without owning Greenland, as he had previously demanded, proclaiming in an interview on Fox Business that he was brokering a deal with, quote, no end or time limit while providing no details. We will have everything we want, he said on Mornings with Maria. We're getting everything we want at no cost. The president suspended his tariff threats on Wednesday after meeting with NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. Trump had declared the tariffs on 8 European nations that opposed his demand for Greenland, which is an autonomous territory of Denmark, would go into effect on February 1st. This reporting from the Washington Post. Alexander.
I hate to sort of be kind of counterintuitive about this, but I wonder if he really had any intention, he and his advisors, to seize Greenland or buy it at all. Here's the thing. The point which he's arrived at now is pretty much what would have been accomplished anyway under quiet diplomacy, which is some perhaps expanded military presence, American military presence in Greenland, and beefed up economic ties. All of that he could have accomplished through the framework of NATO and any number of already existing economic agreements with Denmark and with other countries that are, you know, have interests in Greenland. I think that this all has to do with simply him claiming victory for something, for an achievement that would have been attainable anyway. He wants the publicity. I think that's very important to him. And he's not interested in the idea of quiet diplomacy because then he can't take credit, or it's more difficult to take credit. This is my take on this. I think that there are other sort of aspects of this. I think he was also pitching his, frankly, his kind of an appeal to the Groypers, the far right people in the U.S., because it's kind of a leitmotif of Nazi ideology, this sort of conquering of the far north and the North Pole and also the South Pole to some extent. The achievement is sort of somehow seen as being the crowning a victory of the white race. You see this, you know, throughout like the Nazi period, you know, here and there as a kind of a cultural meme. But I think, I think there's a certain element of shrewdness to this.
It does strike me, and forgive the analogy, but it seems like you park the car outside on the street, and you want to go into the house, and you go to the side of the house, and you start to scale the side of the house on the trellis, mm-hmm. and then you fall, and you go into a bush, but the bush gives you a leg up, and then you go up to the second floor, and that window is locked, but it allows you a foothold to get up to the third floor, which is the attic, and then you're able to break the window open and get in, to which then you meet the dog. The dog goes after you, starts ripping your pants apart, and then you can't get the attic door down from being on top of it, and then ultimately you find a suitcase, and it allows you enough weight to get the thing down. Or you could just go through the front door.
Mm-hmm.
It just seemed like a lot of stuff that had to happen prior to just going, knock, knock, here's what I want.
I think we have to think that with Trump, there's always more than one story. And yes. There's always more than one act. I think Alex is right that to some extent, I don't think he was ever going to go in with a military force to invade Denmark. Denmark or Greenland. I watched the speech yesterday. He kept calling it Iceland, which was pretty hysterical. Not hysterical. It was pretty disturbing. But I don't think he was ever going to go in with force. I agree with that. What I would add is I think there's another thing Trump wanted, right? He didn't just want Greenland for defense purposes. He is in his second term. He's thinking about his legacy. And we have to remember, he is going to go down as probably one of the five most important world leaders in all of history. Mm-hmm. You think of Jesus.
Right.
You think of, Napoleon. you think of Alexander the Great. Mm-hmm. You think of Churchill. I mean, Trump's going to be in that category. And whether you like him or not, he's going to be remembered as one of the great world leaders. And he's thinking about his legacy. And he's a real estate developer, and one of the legacies is he wants to be on Mount Rushmore. We know that. He wants to expand the United States. Mm-hmm. Greenland would be a bigger expansion than the Louisiana Purchase. Mm-hmm. I don't think you can take that. He really wants it, mm-hmm. and I don't think it's over. Mm-hmm. That said, Trump is a deal maker, and he has different goals. He wants to expand the country, but he also wants Greenland for military purposes. I think he was hoping that Europe would back down quickly. Mm-hmm. I think he was hoping that Europe would say, oh my God, we can't do this. Let's just give in to Mr. Trump. And he would buy it. Mm-hmm. Or in some sense. But I think, Europe stood up to him. And I think his advisor said, we bet. And I think Mark Rutte had a huge impact on here. The NATO Secretary General NATO whatever his position is. And I think he has a very good relationship with Trump, and I think they talked, and basically Trump backed down, and I think that's true. But that doesn't mean it's over. I mean, I think he still wants it. I think it's important to him, and we'll see what the next act is. But I agree with you in some way. Like with many things Trump does, the actual thing he does makes a lot of sense. The way he does it is sort of a disaster. And here we may be in that kind of a situation as well.
Even through the headphones, I heard locusts, and it was just a swarm. and then I realized, no, it was just people typing furiously, as you were making the analogy to Jesus. We'll see how that goes. Yeah. I haven't checked yet, but I'll see how that goes. I'll keep you informed. Chris Gibson.
Yeah, so I think there's no question that President Trump aspires to be considered one of the great leaders in history. I think in large part we're going to find out in the next several years. I'm not as confident that he will, in fact, end up in that category in the end, but it certainly is his aspiration. It's his ambition, and he's going to put a lot of energy. And I think that does explain his aggressive posture right out the gate. After the inauguration, making these statements about Canada and Greenland and Panama, and then taking action in Venezuela. So we'll see. On the particulars for Greenland, I think it was pretty evident by the time he got off the plane that short of a military operation, the gambit he was making in terms of an aggressive posture or a bluff, if you will, was not going to work. Mm-hmm. And so not only was there not a path to bring Greenland into the territory of the United States, but politically it was a 75-25 issue with several polls, and he was on the 25 mm-hmm. side. He's got an eye on the midterms. He's constantly keeping this in play. And so he does what he does really well, which is regardless of what most people perceive, he just claims victory and goes home. So that's exactly what he's done here is he's claimed victory and he's coming home. And as to the details, I do agree. I mean, look, and it was always there for him. The fact is that whether it be about security or minerals, Greenland and Denmark and NATO, they've made it patently clear that, yes, you want to put more bases here, please do.
Yeah.
You want to make some investments here and start to work towards some of these minerals, we're in for that too. So it's just the territory that's the red line here. So, you know, there's even, I think he's going to get some language into this framework that allows for renegotiation of the 1959. That's going to allow him to save face. And there is this whole term called the Status of Forces Agreement. Mm-hmm. It does vary from place to place. Mm-hmm. We dealt with this in my time in NATO when I was in the military. So there's going to be enough wiggle room here for him to point some things to say this is slightly, or he won't even say slightly, different
the
from.
The greatest thing.
And,
yeah.
Look,
he's demanding some sovereignty over the bases or something like that.
Reality,
I don't know how it would look.
Well, you know, the reality is that this is something that every base, I mean, I spent time in Berlin in my first tour. Every base, there is that's where the status of forces comes in.
Right.
And has to do with jurisdictions and who's the first one to prosecute if there are issues and how these things get resolved. So he will be able to, I believe, point to that to say that there are some differences in this status of forces. But, you know, for him, it's mostly going to stay at the 30,000-foot level. And the 30,000-foot level is we won and you lost.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the last thing I'd say on this is that, you know, whether it be the missile defense or the navigability of the waters, what's interesting to me as an over-analytical guy, I've been waiting for somebody who disagrees with him to make this point, to say, you know, you're making a big fuss about Greenland, and part of the reason is, and the Arctic, is because the increasing navigability of the Arctic. And why is it more in – why do we navigate more in it? Because, of course, one of his positions has always been is that it's a hoax, you know, the whole idea that the climate's changing. Mm. And this whole posture is very aggressive. You have to at least acknowledge that to try to make this move to help national security. Say, well, what's the assumption behind all that? Mm. I'm just waiting for – I want to see if his staff has prepared him for that.
Yeah.
Or does he give us the deer in headlights? So are you basically acknowledging that the Earth is warming that's causing this iceberg to melt? That's the reason why – and so I'm just – as a curious guy, I'm waiting for that kind of moment.
Well, already the Republicans in the Senate and the House have admitted that, you know, the Earth is warming in various ways and these waterways are becoming more accessible.
Yeah.
So it's interesting at a kind of a lower level of, you know, the Trump kind of, I don't know what you call it, support group. There's already been an acknowledgement of that. And you see that in some ways kind of percolating upwards. The other thing I'd just like to add, you know, here, just to sort of expand, Roger, on your comment and Chris on yours, is that Trump is not a young person. He's looking at his legacy, you know, as you point out already. And I think he's keen to view himself to leave something that'll represent what he's achieved as a world, what Hegel called the world historical figure, you know, not that we were talking about Hegel right before this program, not that Trump reads Hegel, but they're already.
We were talking about Hegel
and the Mets.
And the Mets, that's right.
Hegel, they share Hegel spirit, the spirit in common.
Hegel and the Mets, that's right. I hadn't made that connection actually, but yeah.
It's like Bernie and the Jets.
Yeah, but there's already a sense, you know, in the pro-Trump commentary, intelligentsia, like Ross Douthat, for example, specifically mentioned that. He said, without referring to Hegel, Trump is a world historical figure. And I think that there are people, you know, who advise Trump who do read some of these kind of more cerebral, you know, takes on what he's doing.
One of the things that I think is interesting here, in yesterday afternoon, as this started to develop a little bit more and the playing field at least got the dust had settled a bit, that people were then blaming the media for blowing this out of proportion. And I think even the Trump administration, even Carolyn Leavitt, blamed the media for blowing this out of proportion and making a big deal. I have to say, though, everyone was freaking out about this. I mean, including the administration was freaking out about this. But the world, the leaders of this those in Europe, those elsewhere, obviously those in Greenland and Denmark and Norway. I mean, they were very concerned, and I just think that's a bit of a misnomer to the sense that it was all exaggerated, because it really was played to be a kind of doomsday scenario.
You know, I want to say that the important point that I believe needs to be made is perception in this realm of international politics matters. I'll illustrate. So in 1950, we had a very senior administration official, Secretary of State, who was making this, you know, grandiose speech about the United States' vision for the post-World War II era. And he was talking about these spheres of influence, and he drew lines on maps, and he left Korea out of it. I don't think intentionally that was the point, but it was signaling. This was a perception of what the United States would fight for. And the message that it was received by the Politburo in the Soviet Union and by, to a degree, the communist world, including China, was that America would not go to war over. And you know what happens? We have an invasion of South Korea. Mm-hmm. So these things do matter. There'll be an attempt to sort of say, well, he's just blustering, or this is the art of the deal. I'm not even going to push back on that. I understand that's part of how he goes about his business. Mm-hmm. But what I am saying is there is reality, but perception matters for reality because it does signal and it does cause decision making by friends and foe alike.
Yeah. I mean, the interesting thing about Korea, with the Korean War, the outbreak of the Korean War, was that it was a UN resolution that sort of precipitated or justified American, involvement. There is a sense there of some kind of consensus, any number of different, global organizations like weighing in on what this means. Trump is obviously not interested in that, or he claims he's not interested in that, but I'm not so sure.
Yeah, I would say the media is probably under emphasizing this. The strategic paper that was released in November or December claiming that Europe doesn't matter and we're going to focus on the Don Rowe doctrine. The reason I think Trump is a world historical figure, besides the fact that you can't read any paper in any language in the United States any day without him being the center of attention, is the fact that he is bringing about the end of a 70-year-old liberal world order, which has existed since the end of World War II. Now, there's an argument that it was already ending. There was an argument that it was broken and that it should end. I'm not saying he's wrong, but he is succeeding in bringing about the end of this order that is going to completely change the world for the next generation or so. And we don't know where it's going to go. And that's an extraordinary topic. I wish maybe that the media focused less on nuke and Greenland and focused on the bigger questions, right? Which is that we have a president that is leading us into a very uncertain world. And, again, I think it's easy for liberals sitting here to say, oh, well, suddenly, we're destroying the world order and America's no longer going to act out of ideals. It's going to act from power. Mm. Well, if you're in China or you're in Russia or you're in Iran or you're in Jamaica, they think the U.S. has been acting on power and not on ideals for 70 years. Mm-hmm. They don't believe in the world order. It's not like everyone believed in it. But there was a hypocrisy. And one of the values of hypocrisy is that even if your intentions are otherwise, it makes you at least give lip service to ideas and at least do enough to hold on to the ideals that you create a kind of common world that you can share. And, Trump simply says the world order was hypocritical and we're going to end it. That's an enormous story. And I wish that we were given, you know, and Mark Carney of Canada basically said the world order is over. I heard a speech by Friedrich Merz yesterday as well. Basically said, look, the world is all over. And a lot of Europeans think, look, Trump is not wrong here. We've been a vassal. I forget who said it, but they said it's one thing to be a happy vassal. It's another thing to be an unhappy vassal.
Yeah.
And Europe has to learn to stand on its own. And I think he's pushing them. I hate the way he does it. I despise the way he does it. Mm-hmm. And yet it's not all wrong. And we have to at least take that seriously. And we need the media to actually start having an adult conversation mm-hmm. about where the world is going to go.
So, 90 seconds.
Go ahead. I do want to associate myself with most of those remarks there, and I do think it is consequential. There's no doubt. Incidentally, as somebody who grew up here in upstate New York and has a populist impulse, I also have a deep read of history, which gives me concerns when we don't anchor ourselves in principles, I think, about separation of powers and treating power in a certain way. But I will say this, that it's a note of caution. Even though I've looked at the world order and I do see issues, I think that we were the world's policemen for too long. We led with our chin. There were some decisions we made. We didn't need to use force in some cases. All of that. And I think Trump has been an effective critic of a lot of these things. And then, of course, there's the free rider piece, not just NATO, but the UN and international organizations. That said, my point is that let's not also forget that the biggest benefactor of this world order today is the United States of America.
Right.
So,
yeah.
So while I'm a critic of and I associate myself with some of the things that Trump has said about that, I never lose sight of the fact that nobody benefits more from this array of international power than the United States. So whatever we end up with, we ought to not relegate ourselves from being a benefactor to being and essentially losing.
Yeah, we're in heated agreement on that.
Yeah.
That was Chris Gibson on the Roundtable Panel on Thursday, January 22nd. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable Panel The Week in Review after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. On Friday, January 23rd, Joe was joined by Professor of History and International Relations at Vassar College, Robert Brigham, Tetherless World Senior Constellation Professor of Computer Web and Cognitive Science at RPI, Jim Hendler, Professor of History at CUNY John Jay College of Criminal Justice and the CUNY Graduate Center and Director of the Humanities and Justice Program, Allison Cavey, and Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel.
I'm going to start with an article that I saw in the Washington Post. They had it as their lead last night, and I think it's really interesting. And I don't think we've talked about it a whole lot. And that is that the Trump Budget Office is ordering a review of funds to Democratic-controlled states. President Trump said his administration would cut off federal resources to, quote, sanctuary cities on February 1st. So this is not too far away. The Trump administration has ordered cabinet agencies to review federal funding for a group of Democratic-controlled states. According to a White House budget official and records reviewed by the Washington Post, as the administration looks to cut off resources for sanctuary jurisdictions that refuse to collaborate with immigration enforcement authorities. The White House Office of Management and Budget ordered all federal agencies except the Defense and Veterans Affairs Departments to report every grant, every loan, every contract, every subcontract, and, quote, other monetary awards to a group of 14 states and the District of Columbia, Washington, D.C. The memo sent this week with instructions to report back by January 28th, which I believe is Monday, is says the exercise is meant to, quote, facilitate efforts to reduce the improper and fraudulent use of those funds through administrative means or legislative proposals to Congress. This is a data gathering exercise only. You see, they've used the word exercise twice. The memo states later it does not involve withholding funds and therefore does not violate any court order. But it is reviewing the funds of Democratic-controlled states, which would give you an idea that there is a reason that they want that information. President Donald Trump declared in a speech last week that as of February 1st, the federal government should stop making, quote, any payments to sanctuary cities or states having sanctuary cities because they do everything possible to protect criminals at the expense of American citizens. That reporting from the Washington Post. Any volunteers to start off the conversation? Nick is ready to go.
Sure I am, because I've been talking about this.
Yes, you
actually
have.
So over the last year, there's been a series of efforts to pause grant the flow of funds through grants that had already been approved or accepted and budgets that had already been approved by federal agencies that either directly fund local nonprofits or that flow through state and local governments. There were injunctions on those efforts, and then we saw that this similar effort was put into the notice of funding opportunities, alerting applicants to federal grants that priorities would be changed from previous priorities and points would be deducted from applicants who are operating programs in localities that the federal administration considers sanctuary localities. Sanctuary cities or sanctuary states is sort of a term of art. All it means is that a government has chosen not to include in its budget funding for the support of ICE activity by its local tax base. So in the city of Albany, for example, it just says that its law enforcement budget is already stretched too thin and it can't afford to extend additional financial resources to assist ICE in administering immigration laws because it has its own duties and its own obligations to the residents of the city. The Trump administration has told funders and therefore applicants for grants that if they're operating a program in a city like Albany, they would lose points in their application and be less competitive in programs that they otherwise did not previously lose those grants. So this example is the HUD COC continuums of care funding that we talked about a few months ago, which supports anti-homelessness and homelessness prevention programs.
So you work, the Legal Aid Society works very hard in advocacy regarding sanctuary cities. Is that correct?
No. No, we don't.
Okay. But you have a connection.
We don't have an immigration program at all. We've actually been prohibited by federal regulation to assist or serve undocumented immigrants, except in very rare cases relating to human trafficking and domestic violence. So our program has nothing to do with what the city's immigration policy is, actually. And really...
But does it impact you? Does this action impact you?
It does, because my program exists in the city. And just because we do homelessness prevention work in a city that this administration identifies as a sanctuary city, then my program would lose points on its application to continue doing anti-homelessness work.
You got it. Okay. And
that's what's so interesting about it. The program doesn't have to be doing anything at odds with the administration's position on immigration enforcement, but they will lose points because of where they operate their homelessness prevention program.
Jim.
And, you know, Joe, I just want to say this is extending things already going on. People may remember from the last fundraiser before they give their money to this one. We had the Trinity Alliance of the Capital Region, which is one of the oldest charities in Albany, runs food banks, runs amazing programs, right? They had $10 million coming from a federal grant to build a major center to help improve life down in the parts of Albany, you know, South Central,
South
things
End.
Like that.
Yeah.
And it just got put on hold. And it's a year later, and we're still waiting for the law, for the whole legal process to work out, because just suspending it and then later canceling it without due notice and all those things. And, you know, it was part of the $20 million grant that was to help all of Albany, and it was coming from the EPA. It's just, you know, sort of this is just adding attack on attack. Obviously, being in a several of us are at universities in a blue state. In fact, poor Nick is outnumbered today by professors. And, you know, every grant, I mean, this is insane. The other thing that's insane is there's no possible way to get all this data in a week. This is not data that's kept in a central state database. They can do it. You know, if it would take months to get that data, all of it, and for real, and together, and in an analyzable form. So I suspect the next thing that will happen is the states will send something and or sue. If they don't sue, then you're going to see the feds come back and say, well, you didn't give us all the information, so we're cutting funds. You know, so it's set impossible terms and then say, and there will be penalties if you don't meet them.
What happened in the HUD case, though, is there is an injunction, but the injunction came so late in the application process that organizations chose not to apply because we couldn't meet the deadline to apply by the time we learned there was going to be an injunction. And the injunction doesn't mean that the rules or the intent of the changes won't still be implemented at a future date. And so some organizations, my organization, backed out of that application and that program entirely because we just have an awareness that, like, we won't be able to meet the new requirements anyway.
Just to be clear, this wasn't the HUD one. This was one that was approved in 2018, 2019.
Right.
So, it was – I'm sorry, 2022, 2023. It was pre-Trump, and it was just the EPA and came in and said, we're just freezing these things that help poor people.
And the courts haven't been great on this. I mean, there have been four federal judges that have split evenly on whether this can go through or not. And the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals recently lifted this injunction and says this is really a matter for, you know, U.S. Court of Claims. The fundamental legal question here is, can the executive branch cut funding that's already been approved by Congress? And the Supreme Court so far has said... Not totally, but there are some instances where we grant, where we see that the president does have that kind of authority. So hoping that the courts are the backstop for this is not a winning strategy either.
I would just encourage us to also pull back and think about this as a strategy that the president has adopted for punishing his political enemies and bringing them to heel. So if you can look at the Jack Smith case, but you can also look at the many personal vendettas he's carrying out. I mean, the Clintons this week, as you discussed already, have been called in on contempt. So I think this is a way of trying to see if he can use executive power to bring the states to heel. And if he can, then great. And if he can't, and if they challenge it, it takes a while. And he still gets what he wants, because it means that the states that have stood up against him and maintained some sense of not cooperating with ICE for reasons that are sometimes financial, sometimes political, are going to be less well-funded, less capable of providing for their citizens. And in a moment where his polls show he's economically very weak, it does make him a little bit stronger sometimes in those places.
Although I do hope that, you look at New York, right, where House seats are going to be very contentious in 2026. And I, without getting to violating the rules of what can be said on public radio, let me simply say that if you are living in an area that has a contested race going on, where you're trying to decide between the parties, just keep in mind what the current Republican governments are doing to New York State, even if you live on Long Island.
Or Syracuse.
So what I guess I'm also interested in just what does this mean for the idea of sanctuary cities overall?
So on a kind of a technical basis, this administration and many other administrations have already faced rulings by courts that they aren't allowed to coerce states into policy changes. But I think what this step indicates is that the administration's interested in doing a deeper dive into what it is allowed to do. And there are a lot of changes that it's authorized through formal rulemaking processes. And so I do think that the first, you know, bite at the apple was these sweeping executive orders. The second bite was through an overhaul of NOFO priorities before having completed really the whole rulemaking process. I think now they're demonstrating, you know, a kind of a focus on the more official pathways to getting to the same ends.
Anybody else? When you think of then we move forward on this and of the, I guess I'm interested in the programs. I mean, this goes to a long list of things that will be, that will once again be cut, and not just cut overall, but cut specifically for blue states.
It's $10 billion, $7 billion to the temporary assistance for needy families and $2.4 billion to child care. I mean, that's a significant chunk of HHS budget. I mean, it's huge.
We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we would love to hear from you on this Friday morning in regards to any of the topics that we discussed this morning. Anybody else on that?
Well, let me throw in one last thought on this, which is that in a lot of the discussions in the roundtable over the past few weeks, particularly those that have been more contentious, a lot of people have been saying we have to stop looking at some of these issues as red state, blue state, or as Democrat, Republican, issues of some of these ICE issues, the whole Minneapolis thing. We've had people saying, you know, let's look at the facts. Let's try not to think of this as a political issue. When you target only the blue states, right, and ask who is it who's trying to turn everything into a political issue, it just becomes a lot clearer that that's not the way the current government is looking at, let's make rational decisions based on things having to do with what's happening where. Again, you know, several of the cities that they've sent troops into have lower crime rates than cities that they haven't sent to that just happen to have voted for the party that's not currently in power, things like that. So again, the, you know, Libby always talks about how Trump really feeds on hate. And this is just another example of trying to create tension to force people to look at everything through a political lens.
Yeah, I don't know if you saw this yesterday, but one of the talking head supporters of the administration said that the same exact thing that's going on in Minneapolis is going on in every city in Texas. But because they have local law enforcement cooperation, we don't see the chaos, which is...
Or the ICE agents.
Yeah, it's like Alice in Wonderland.
That was Robert Brigham on the Roundtable panel on Friday, January 23rd. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. This has been this week's Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Thank you for listening.